The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. Coming up, I'll be talking with Larry Oakes, who is a saxophone player and composer and member of many different ensembles over a great many years, who specialize in various types of contemporary improvisation, having to do with jazz sometimes directly, having to do with, you could say, with world music, but in any event, fusing traditional, fusing various types of musical elements. He is in town with a group based in San Francisco, I believe, called Kinoua, which is spelled K-I-H-N-O-U-A. They're performing a free concert at 7:30 tonight at the Krannert Art Museum and Kincaid Pavilion on the University of Illinois campus in Champaign. And that is the 30th concert on the Sudden Sound Concert Series at the Krannert Art Museum. So that's a bit of a milestone, that series curated by Jason Finkelman. So conversation with Larry Oakes coming up. But first on the show, I'll be talking with a man who became something of an institution at the University of Illinois up through 1992, when he retired from here anyway. His name is Shozo Sato. He was a professor at the university. He's founder of Japan House. He was the director of a number of kabuki plays at the university, and he is coming back as a guest director for the Department of Theater to present Lady Macbeth, a kabuki play, at the Krannert Center in Urbana. That opens tonight and continues through the 7th of April with quite a number of performances in the interim. I'll be talking with Shozo Sato coming up very shortly here on Live and Local. Thank you. That is an example of part of what could be called an overture to a kabuki play. In this case, Soshiro Sato's adaptation of Shakespeare's Othello, which was done some years ago, I presume at the University of Illinois, but
yes,
perhaps somewhere else. Soshiro Sato's my guest on this portion of Live and Local. He was for a long time professor at the University of Illinois, founder of Japan House and director of various kabuki plays, and has been off doing quite a number of other things since then, still directing, and he's back on campus to direct Lady Macbeth, a kabuki play through the University of Illinois Theater Department, and I'm very pleased to welcome you on the show. Thanks very much for coming in. It's great to meet you after all these years.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Your biography says that you're a master of various kinds of Zen arts, that you've had education from some folks who have were long-time institutions, by which we mean hundreds of years, in Japan, in the kabuki tradition as well. And I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of your own personal background that has that brought you to where you are, and particularly brought you to want to bring the kabuki experience to viewers, listeners, concert goers, and so on. Theater goers.
This is going to be a long story, have to be very short. My mission, if I may use the word, for being in the United States, and especially at the University of Illinois, from the very beginning was to introduce what is Japanese traditional art and culture is. In fact, 1964, when I was appointed at College of Fine Applied Art, I was the first Japanese humanity curriculum faculty. Until then, many famous Japanese scientists was in residence. But as in a Japanese humanity program, such as traditional arts, well, I was the first. Then since then, I have given many different opportunities, such as teaching in classes, studio class, lecture class, etc. But it is limited in the number of students in each class, studio class, maybe 15 the maximum. And such way, my mission is somehow narrowed down to the only young generation, but I want to reach out to more of a general public. And so 1969, Kurana Center for the Performing Art was grand opened. And then I was honored to be chosen as an artist in residence since opening of Kurana Center till my retirement. And as my job for grand opening performance, I presented a Japanese kabuki dance concert. And great honor to meet Mr. and Mrs. Cranard. They came in on a wheelchair, and I can greet them and talk to them. And this was a once-in-a-lifetime honor. And so soon after, they passed on to another world. And so that was the very last moment that I get to meet with him. So since I have given this great facilities of Kurana Centers as an artist in residence, I come up with kabuki theater curriculum and start teaching kabuki in the classes. And then at the end result, every year we start producing kabuki. At first 10 years was traditional kabuki, and I translated dialogue, script, into English to match that length. And then you have to have a background music. That's the unique part of kabuki theater. Ka is music or song. Bu is dance. Ki is acting. So three major and basic components of performing art have to be blended in to make kabuki theater. And so teaching these art forms in one semester is not really long enough, because most of kabuki actors spend lifetime to perfect their works. So we had a great understanding by the deans, and so the student can take kabuki class for up to 4 semester. And so that means by that time they are pretty good to perform kabuki. And so we did perform traditional kabuki, how traditional kabuki are made and what was the subject and such. And that was really a wonderful experience for both my side and my student, and then for general public.
Can you talk about what is traditional kabuki? Because I assume you're going to contrast that
yes,
with what came later.
Yes, and that is called fusion kabuki, or Irinai kabuki, we start saying.
Ear and eye?
Irinai.
Oh, Irinai, uh-huh. As in, yeah, Illinois,
yes,
yeah, right.
Irinai kabuki, because we start using Shakespeare's and then Greek tragedies as a storytelling aspect. So then that is the Irinai fusion kabuki, and before that was traditional kabuki, still performing in Japan in Japanese, but of course here have to be in English. So that was taken.
So what does traditional kabuki look like? What are some of the themes? What are the things that you would present in that?
Well, kabuki have almost 400 year of history and many hundred of superb playwrights. So we have over 3,000 script available. You can think of any incident in human life. It's already made into the plays. So Shakespeare have produced many famous Shakespearean plays, but not so compares in the number wise. And the standard, most popular kabuki plays about 350s. And so constantly they depict many different human tragedies, to the happiness, to the comics, all of different classes. And court nobility class to powerful warrior class, and then commoner class, and all these different classes, and to appeal general public of Japan since 1600 to today. And so they're very wide. And so what we had at the beginning is very simple stage set. One set of pine tree are painted, simulated on a wooden panel backdrop. And then everything stylized in no drama style, which is a very simplified way of movement.
No, as spelled N-O-H.
Yes, N-O-H, thank you. And so that way we can start not only educating my students, but general public. This is one of the traditional kabuki. It's easier to develop interest to it. And so we did two of those play called Monstrous Spider. And this is one of the very popular play. And the monk come out in one night to the Lord's residence, and he was ill. And because this illness was cause of this monstrous spider who wants to take over Japan. And so monks appear, and then Lord felt strange about this monk's gesture. And then he asked, who are you? And then he suddenly threw web at Lord, the one from one hand, when you split, and like paper tapes, long tapes, like a long time ago when ship depart from port, people usually throw those tapes from the ships and such.
That they call it ticker tape, I guess.
Right? Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. And those are made especially for the theater in Japan, and go on to about 50 feet long, very thin tape, almost a cassette tape-like size. And so that's covered whole floor, and that was very exciting. And then act two is that in the deep in the mountain, so the Lord have sent the warriors to diminish this evil spider and the big fighting sequence with literally 15 of those fantastic theatrical effect web thrown by the spider. So entire stage is covered with webs. And so this was really one of the most popular piece. And another piece we did was warrior, brave warrior and demon. And this is also based on tradition, well, historic play in Japan. I shouldn't say historic play, history. And so this warrior was very, very brave, and he cut off the demon's arm. And one night, pretend to be an aunt who looked after this warrior when he was infant. And she came to see warrior, and then he said, I cannot meet anybody. I'm in this religious practice to avoid any influence by the demons. And then she cry, and say, I have given all my love to you to grow up, and yet you have not willing to meet me, etc., etc. So he finally opened the gate and then entertained her. And then while there's entertaining, she become demon. And then she retrieved her arm or his arm and then flew up, and then combat between demon and brave warrior, but brave warrior couldn't catch him, and demon escaped into the crowd in such place. So stage set was simply one pine tree painted on the background. So that was very simple. And then from there, a little bit more realistic type of play, Shunkan, the exile monk. This is also from the Japanese history. This monk, high priest of Buddhism, but he was involved in treating governmental takeover, and he was sent to island, and he had to live in island by himself. And whole stage set was painted as ocean, and a small island was created at the end. And envoy came, and he was not given pardon, and all his colleagues was pardoned and returned to main island of Japan, but he had to live there by himself. And so he climbed up to the top of rock, and during that time the stage turns, and then in the middle of the whole stage, all painted ocean, and there is island, and then monk stands, and then yearning for human beings, say goodbye, and that's a very sad and dramatic scene. And so we did this type of play, and that was also very, very, very popular.
So the first time when you say very stylized,
yes,
you mean probably two things. One is that the story itself is sort of fantastical. Mm-hmm. You know, you have big spiders, and it sounds like some of those Japanese monster movies.
Exactly.
Or you have demons. Mm-hmm. Whereas more realistic, you have something that's based a little more on real life. But I assume also by stylized, you're talking a bit also about the way in which actors act.
Yes.
They don't act in what would be a realistic way. They don't necessarily look like real people. There's masks, there's paintings of faces, and particularly stylized costumes and so on.
Yes, that's the characteristic too of Kabuki theater. Thank you for pointing out that question so I can answer to that. And that is, Kabuki theater is really based on study of our life, natural life, and then crystallize all these incidents and human emotion, and then exaggerate it and expand on the stage. And so common way of explaining Kabuki theater system is stylization and exaggeration, exaggerating real life to the bigger than life, based on crystallizing of the fact of our life. And thus, the process makes Kabuki theaters unique in every aspect, stage set, as well as the makeup and costume and gesture and movement, even in dialogue. Dialogue not spoken, but more of semi-chanting, and to exaggerate a certain important word. So, for example, today is slightly cool day. So then we say, today is slightly cool day. And so cool day become exaggerated. And so in a gesture and everything in based on this concept, so far from common TV audience knowledge of acting, it's very, very different.
Although, you know what I was just thinking about, there's certain older styles of television comedy,
yes,
that may be represented by, for some reason, I got the image of Lucille Ball.
Oh, yes, Lucille Ball, yes.
Who would have that sort of exaggerated mm-hmm. way of speaking. Mm-hmm. Not that I suspect she's studied kabuki theater. But, and then the exaggerated gesture, I assume, is where the dance comes in.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the dance,
yes,
is going to give very stylized,
yes,
depiction of how somebody might react physically.
Uh-huh. So all kabuki actors' movement is based on dance movement. And in fact, many of the famous kabuki actors are head of a big kabuki dance school. So that is one of the unique strengths as a kabuki performers.
I want to play a segment of music that you provided for us that you told me might occur in the middle of a drama where something dramatic or mysterious is about to happen,
yes.
I think. Here's just a little bit of this.
This music is as in a background music for when Macbeth would start thinking of murdering King Duncan. And then in the script of Shakespeare's play, he's thinking about a sword. But in kabuki theater, we actually bring out the sword by witches. Three witches. Have a long sword on the end of a bamboo and then bring up above Macbeth and then floating in air left and right, and Macbeth trying to capture the sword. And such a mysterious scene, we use this type of music. So, same way with the script, we have many, many different type of music set for kabuki scene, such as the entrance of a princess. They have set music. The moment you hear this music, every audience know, oh, the princess is going to appear, or the court nobility appears, or any of the situation, even just beating drums, or this is sound of ocean waves, or sound of wind against pine trees and such. And so all stylized systems have been incorporated in the music.
My guest on Live and Local, this portion of the show, is Shozo Sato, who was a long time at the University of Illinois, producing and directing kabuki theater, and he's back to direct Lady Macbeth, a kabuki play at the Krannert Center in Urbana, where he was involved in the very first season of the Krannert Center. And so we've left ourselves with just a few minutes to find out what made you decide to start producing Shakespeare in kabuki theater.
After we have done traditional kabuki for 10 years, and then we start thinking how we can introduce that knowledge, wealth in kabuki as a convention, how we can apply to another form of the theater. But key is audience have to know the storyline first so they can see adaptation, how Kabuki element can be recognized. And for that reason, Macbeth is one of the most popular classic of the West. And then after that, we went to the Greek tragedy like Medea. And so everybody know the plot. And then when we do it in Kabuki, even though we use the same name from Shakespeare or Greek tragedy in Medea, but everybody dressed and made up in Japanese character. And so they don't see any strangeness in having Western name with the Japanese face. And so that way that we can overlap audience knowledge and then Kabuki information to make play presentable and more richer and appreciated by the audience. For that reason, we start adapting Western plays.
So when you adapt Shakespeare, are the lines that they are speaking or exaggerating,
yes,
are they lines from Shakespeare or are they not necessarily?
At the beginning, we tried to do that, but become too long of a line. And because of Kabuki song and dance and acting, dance acting part died out because of delivery of dialogue so long. So we have cut short to fit to the Kabuki formula. And then during those days, English department senior professor heard that we are doing Shakespeare, Macbeth. And so they're with us long time. They told us, you cannot cut that line. That's very important to the Shakespeare. You cannot cut that line. So we negotiated and made first one. And then from there on, we start rewriting entire script based on Shakespeare or Medea, but in more poetry form of Shakespeare, Kabuki dialogue delivery.
So very much a reinterpretation.
Yes, exactly.
Both visually and of the text.
Exactly.
With a different.
That's
line.
Why people start calling fusion Kabuki.
Yeah. Were you essentially the pioneer of this sort of thing?
I think so. And in this extent, performance and educating student was the only place in the United States.
And now people are bringing you to do it elsewhere? Is that part of how you're spending your time since retirement?
I did many different places, mainly professional companies. But I'm always enjoy to work with the young student because they are like a piece of white paper. They can observe all this information and then they perform as I ask. And so I am always amazed how wonderful they are.
Well, you can see the students from the theater and the dance department?
No, theater department.
And then I imagine they have to work with some dancers, or are they just getting all of them
from me, yes.
All right, so, excuse me. That production of Lady Macbeth, a Kabuki play, opens tonight at 7:30 at the Krannert Center, runs through this Sunday with a matinee on Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock. Also have a matinee tomorrow, Saturday at 2 o'clock, and then continues next week, Wednesday through Saturday, for evening performances at 7:30. There's also a youth series performance next Tuesday at 11 o'clock. You can get a summary of all this stuff on on the Krannert Center website, which is krannertcenter.com. And Shoso Sato, it's been a great pleasure to meet you, and it's wonderful to hear just this tiny scratching of the surface of what Kabuki is and what you have made it. Specifically here at the University of Illinois. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you for asking me to be back here.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Stay tuned next for a conversation with Larry Oakes, saxophonist and composer, who will be on campus tonight for a performance with his ensemble called Quinoa. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. You can see Villages, Castles, and Manors from Masterpiece and Mystery and more in England and Wales for 14 days, beginning September 27th. If American history appeals, board WYLL's Civil War train, private vintage train cars leaving for the southern battlefields with historian Anthony Pitch, September 7th. Information is available at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300. We have support for today's broadcast from Docha, presenting the 2012 Docha Festival, featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts March 30th through April 3rd at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org. And on tomorrow's show, we will be having, among our few guests, Rudolf Hocken, who is viola professor at the University of Illinois and involved in the Docha Festival. He'll be presenting a composition of his for viola and piano. So that'll be part of tomorrow's show. And I hope you'll join us then from noon till 1. Stay tuned for my conversation with Larry Oakes. That is a portion of music called the Jukebox Suite, as performed by the Rova Saxophone Quartet, and the specific section is called Jukebox Afro-Balkan, and one of the four members of that quintet is Larry Oakes, who is a saxophonist, composer, and present and former member of any of a number of groups that have to do with different kinds of newer music, including one of the groups of which he is a present member and chief composer for. It's called, depending upon how you want to pronounce it, Kihnoua. It's spelled Kihnoua. And they are giving the 30th of the Sudden Sound concerts in that series at the Cranet Art Museum on the University of Illinois campus, on the Champaign side of that campus, tonight at 7:30. It's a free program. And I'm pleased to have Larry Oakes on the phone with us right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
So I sort of qualified the pronunciation of this word, which in any event doesn't explain, and so I'll let you explain why that name and where does it come from and why apply it to a new music quartet.
Well, I think the hardest thing you do when you're a musician is figure out names for your pieces, for your bands, for your ensembles, whatever. Like, I'm in Rova Saxophone Quartet, and basically we just gave up and just, you know, said, okay, R-O-V-A, it's an acronym from the first letter of everybody's name. And we thought we'd play two concerts and we'd be done anyway, so it didn't matter. But 30 years later, it's still there. We have to live with that one. So Kihnoua, my wife is a writer, poet, and she has lots of research books around to help her with her books. And I was kind of thumbing through a Greek thesaurus dictionary of ancient Greek and just looking for a word that made sense. And I saw Kihnoua, which, of course, Greek is like Latin. It's a dead language, and there are no recordings of people speaking it from ancient times.
We're talking about ancient Greek here.
The words can have any pronunciation you want to put on them, essentially. And when you spell the word Kihnoua, you get a lot of different pronunciations from people announcing it on stage who haven't asked you how to pronounce it. And, of course, they're not wrong. I mean, that's the thing.
But what does it mean?
The other thing is, as far as the word goes, it had about 15 possible definitions. And that was another thing I liked, that they were all, this probably means. I don't know, there's something about that, because we're playing a kind of music that can go in many different directions, even though it is composed, because everyone's like a great improviser, and I take advantage of that. And so Kihnoua for me means the difference, the unity of opposites, and, you know, things along that line that were some of the definitions that were there.
So what might one of some of the opposites be in this group?
Well, in this group, traditional folk music and avant-garde forms, let's say, or new forms, or forms for the compositions that I've created myself that are obviously completely contemporary. And I have been a big fan of Korean pansori music, which is a, you know, very ancient Korean folk music that usually involves one singer, often female, singing with maybe one accompanying drummer. And there also are ensembles playing music with singers and stuff in Korean that are from Korea that are just great listening. I was a big fan, and I always dreamed someday I'd like to go to Korea and find a Korean singer to play with. And then about 5 years ago in 2007, I was invited to do a small festival thing in San Francisco where I live, and on the same bill was a Korean performance artist who had just come from Seoul to San Francisco to make her way in the art scene there. And she was doing a performance piece, but it involved her doing some amazing vocalese. And I thought, wow, if she could improvise, I would love, you know, I've got to find her. And it took me about a year to hook up with her, but here we are.
And her name is Do-hee Lee.
Yeah. Right, Do-hee Lee. I would say that if anybody takes a chance and comes out tonight for this concert, they are going to be blown away by her overall talent, abilities, all the things she can do vocally, and just her whole presence on stage is really a pleasure. It's really, when she first started playing with me, she knew about improvising. She'd done some, but, you know, everybody's tentative at the beginning, and she just exploded. Just a great artist as far as vocals goes now. Absolutely fantastic.
So that's, I presume, another sort of, if not juxtaposition of opposites, at least juxtaposition of slightly different approaches to music, which is that, as you alluded earlier, these are compositions, so at least some of each of them is written out, but because you've got improvisers, some of it isn't written out.
Right. I'm basically creating terrains, known terrains. If you think about your GPS and you've got your map there, you can see all the hills and the streets coming up, but then if you stop thinking about your GPS and just think of a map, there's a lot of different ways to go. And so I tell them where I want them to go and how I want them to get there, but exactly the route they take and the way they say, you know, the way they speak on their instruments is more up to the individual improviser. So like Dohi has the Pansori training. She studied that in Seoul when she was at the university. She's not a Pansori singer, per se, in the sense that she went through the rigors of all of the training that those people have to go through before they actually are allowed on stage. But she did study it, and she does not sing, as a Pansori artist in this group. She's an improviser. But if you didn't know what I just said, you probably would think you were hearing somebody telling stories in Korean, which is exactly what the real Pansori singers do. There's these Pansori tunes can last 20 minutes. They can last, in a theater performance in Korea, they can last 3 hours. They're long stories. They're like formal operas that the audience knows well, even though they've come to hear it again, you know. And it's a very popular form there. Popular in the way that opera is popular here.
So among a certain population, it's popular.
Yes, exactly. I don't think, as she said yesterday when we were driving, and one of the guys who was kind of programming the iPod into the car suddenly flipped to Guns N' Roses, and she went, oh, that's what I listened to when I was a teenager. So the story's the same, you know. The pop music is everywhere, but as it is in the U.S., opera, you know, opera is not some underground music. Every city has, every big city has an opera, and it does pretty well.
Well, let's give a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about musically, of the sort of thing that folks might hear tonight. This music is the first part of a much longer piece, about a 14-minute piece. It comes off of the CD that Kinawa produced called The Sibyl's Whisper, which has some photos of some, frankly, really eerie photo of these child mannequins, a couple of which are missing arms and other limbs and so on. And the tune is called Flutter. Before we actually hear it, let's clarify that your group consists of you on saxophones, Dohi Lee,
right,
voice, and sometimes hand drum, and Scott Amendola on drums and electronics, and then some other fourth person that changes.
Always a string player, but almost 100% of the time, always a string player. And we've kind of gravitated towards the bass in the last couple of years. And on this tour, we've got the great Trevor Dunn on bass, on electric bass, actually. Trevor, for people who are listening, has worked a lot with John Zorn on a lot of his projects, all different projects John does, both the classical and the improvised stuff, and with many other jazz and rock groups over the years. Yeah.
So let's listen a little bit of this tune. It's a composition of Larry Oakes, who is my guest here on Live and Local. The tune is called Flutter, the ensemble Quinoa, and they'll be at the Krannert Art Museum tonight at 7:30, a free concert. It's the 30th concert on the Sudden Sound Concert Series, and you're listening to Live and Local. That was the opening music of a tune called Flutter, composed by Larry Oakes. Well, partly composed by Larry Oakes, it's also co-composed as the piece progresses by his colleagues in the group called Quinoa, who are Dohi Lee, Scott Amendola on the drums and electronics, and on this recording, how did you say the name? Wilbert?
Wilbert DeYoda.
Oh, DeYoda.
Wilbert DeYoda.
Yeah. Not spelled like the Star Wars character at all.
No, you wouldn't. I knew I had to ask him before I announced it the first time.
Yeah, looks like yeah. DeJude, DeJoode.
Yeah, it looks like yeah. Jude.
So that piece, Flutter, what was going on there?
Well, like I said, I try and create an architecture within which we do the work. And each piece has maybe 7 to 15 sections that transition in and out of each other. And that they're just trying to set up a mood that we try and sustain over the 12 to 20 minutes of the piece. And this one is a very kind of laid back. We're going for certain harmonic sounds and a certain kind of overall landscape beauty that we're looking for. And it starts with the sopranino. I'm playing sopranino on this piece, and bass playing a little notated melody that we don't play exactly in unison, but we both play through the melody, and then we work with the pitch sets that are in the melody for maybe in another. Well, actually, on the record, we just play through the melody. And towards the end of the melody, the vocalist comes in kind of in the same vein, in the same kind of feeling, and she's got a little written stuff that she works off of. And in this piece, Scott Amendola actually never touches the drums. Everything he does is generally just off the electronics, unless he gets inspired maybe to throw a cymbal sound in there, or something like a gong or something like that. And that's how it starts, and it moves through. Basically, what I'm doing is I'm setting up who's in and who's out and a certain sound parameter. And that's really all you need to know. I mean, it's really about being inside the music and just flowing with into the areas that it goes and enjoying it.
So not really that much unlike more traditional jazz composition and creation. And I don't mean, when I say traditional jazz, I don't mean trad jazz. I just mean things that aren't really new music sort you're doing.
I agree with you completely. Yeah. Although I would also say that much contemporary new music is working in this way too, in a global sense, if you were looking down on it, as opposed to being inside it. Yeah, it's very often 100% notated, but you think of somebody like John Luther Adams, he's really going for kind of a landscape that he's trying to fill in with his orchestral pieces or whatever it happens to be, a particular piece. So, yeah, I mean, I've been influenced a lot by contemporary, or late 20th century composers, and it's a big part of how I think about things.
I just have a quick question for you. Since you mentioned that on that composition you were playing sopranino saxophone, which for the uninitiated, that just means, I think it's the smallest of the saxophones.
It isn't anymore,
the
but
highest. Oh, is there a higher one now?
About the rest.
What do they say, sopranino or something?
Soprillo.
A soprillo. Oh, how about that?
The fifth above that, yeah.
Why did you decide to pick that one? When you could have just done the soprano and the tenor.
Well, I had a soprano, and I was living in Mendocino County in the middle 1970s, and I was trying to start a recording studio using windmill electricity. But after 2 years of trying, I suddenly was told that actually this windmill could never work in California. There wasn't enough wind. So in the process of selling it, one day a guy came up to look at it, and he said he couldn't pay for it right then, but he definitely wanted it. And he had this instrument. He knew I was a musician, was I interested, and he pulled out this instrument, and I'd never seen one. And of course it was a saxophone, and then it was a sopranino. And he said, "I'm going to leave this as a deposit. I'll be back next week." And
he never came back.
He never showed up. I never saw him again. I never heard a word. He didn't leave me a phone number.
And you had your new calling.
So I had it. And when I started playing it, I'm a big fan of, besides Korean music, of Indian music and the Chennai and all that Pakistani, those wind instruments. And the sopranino just was right where I live, whereas the soprano was not. It was more of a jazz thing. And there were four or five soprano saxophone players like Steve Lacy and Evan Parker, who I was in total awe of, and I couldn't imagine what else I could possibly do that they hadn't already done. So the sopranino just made more sense, and I've never been sorry. Yeah, I love playing it.
Well, there's not that many folks out there doing it, so that sort of lends another element of distinction.
Yeah.
My guest is Larry Oakes, who is a composer for and leader of the band called Quinoa. It's really a quartet somewhat fluid quartet because there's three folks in it regularly and then a fourth person that varies from time to time. Larry Oakes, tenor and sopranino sax, Dohi Lee, the vocalist, Scott Amendola, drums and electronics. They're all going to be at the Cranet Art Museum tonight at 7:30 on the Sudden Sound Concert Series, which is curated by Jason Finkelman. And thanks to Jason for letting me know that you guys were coming. And for tonight's performance, it'll be bassist Trevor Dunn. I want to go out here with what is the fourth piece on this particular CD that we're sampling. It's called The Sibyl's Whisper. And the title here just says, ... in progress, ... Does that literally mean that this is a piece that isn't done yet, or is that just the title?
Well, the truth is that none of these pieces are ever done. Or once they're done, we stop playing them. They evolve from performance to performance. It's a beautiful thing about this kind of music. It's why I do it. It's what keeps me excited. So yeah, it is in progress, and it has changed quite a bit. But the structure is there. If you listen to that whole piece all the way through, and then you go hear us, you would recognize it. But certain parts of it have grown, become longer, I think maybe a little more interesting. But that's from the inside. Yeah.
So, folks,
I love the CD, so I'm fine with. People will be happy if they hear what's on there, even though it's evolved since then. Yeah.
So folks might hear some version of that tonight, or the next version of that.
In fact, I'm actually thinking about starting with that piece at this concert because of the nature of the room. I played in the room before, and I think it might be a good one for us to open up with.
Well, here's a part of Larry Oakes's In Progress from the CD The Sibyl's Whisper. And it's tonight at the Cranet Art Museum, 7:30. Thanks a lot for joining us on the show.
Happy to do it.
That's the very opening of the version of the piece called In Progress, featuring Larry Oakes on sopranino saxophone, and in this recording, Wilbert de Yoda on the bass. Eventually, they'll be joined by a vocalist, Dohi Lee, and Scott Amendola on the rest of that recording, who will, of course, join Larry Oakes and bassist Trevor Nunn on the concert tonight at the Cranet Art Museum, because the whole group constitutes Quinoa. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. We'll have a mostly sunny and cooler afternoon with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high will be 65. Then tonight, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low of 52 degrees. We're currently at 56.